Thank you, Ernie. My name's Bob McKinney. I'm a real alcoholic. Hi, everybody. Well, I tell you what, you know, I want to thank Liz and the committee or whoever's responsible for having me down here this weekend. This has been great. You know, our Book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that normally we won't mix or mingle us alcoholics until we get in our to get into the rooms. Well, I met a lot of you since I've been down here, and I'll tell you right now, I'd have got drunk with any of you. Somebody asked me one time, said, do you get nervous before you talk? And I said, sure. But Jack Hess from Louisville, Kentucky, told me this story one time, and I know it's a true story because alcoholics don't lie. And he was talking about this young man. His sponsor told him, said, now, son, said, when you get to be or have a year of sobriety, he said, you got to stand behind the podium at your home group and tell your story. And the kid said, no, I can't do that. He said, I'll have a panic attack. I'll black out. I'll pass out. I can't do that. And the sponsor told him, said, look, said, it's a secret to it. It's a trick to it. And he said, really? He said, yeah. He said, man, don't worry about it. So he got up there behind the podium after a year, and the sponsor pulled him over to the side, and he said, now, what do I do? What do I do? What do I do? He said, well, when you get up there, introduce yourself, tell them your home group and your sobriety date, and you look out in the audience, and you find the dumbest, goofiest-looking man that you can find. And you look at him the whole time you're making your talk, and all of a sudden, God will kick in, and you'll do a great job. God said, will it work? And he said, sure, it'll work. The guy looked at this man out there, and he said, hey, I'm looking at you, and I'm starting to feel the God kicking in. And this kid made a great talk. And after the talk, everybody was telling him what a great job he has done. And about that time, this old boy he'd been looking at all day long came up and cold cocked him, knocked him flat on his back. And the guy jumped up, and he said, was it that bad? He said, hell no, we got the same sponsor. Now, I got three guys in here that I can look at them. Joe's over there, and there's Chuck, and there's Jay. So if I glance all around, don't take it personally, guys. When I tell you I'm a real alcoholic, three things happen for me. When I take a drink, I can't tell you how much I'm going to drink, can't tell you when I'm going to stop drinking, and cannot tell you what my behavior is going to be when I start and stop. But because of a loving God, people like you in rooms like this, and an old man named Sterling Fletcher Wash III, who's passed on to the big boys up in the sky. I didn't like him very much because he intimidated me. But he cared more about hurting my feelings than getting me well, and he did hurt my feelings. And because of that, I hadn't found it necessary to take a drink since September 17, 1983. And if you don't like me, it's your fault. It's your fault, because I was not like me when I came in. I didn't take my first drink until I was 16, but I could use one in the third grade. And the reason I said that, because I grew up in a little small town called Manning, South Carolina. Now, if you've never been to Manning, South Carolina, don't worry about you. You ain't missing a whole lot. But it was my mom and I, because my dad decided to leave my mom when I was about a year and a half old, and we lived in that little small town. And see, I had another problem, too. I had a problem of perception. Because I looked around at what everybody else had and what I had and what we had, and we had less. And see, we lived in the smallest house in that town. Everybody in that town had a brother and a sister and a daddy. Everybody had a car except us. And so I'd walk to school. And people would stop and ask me, said, Bob, don't you want to ride to school? And I'd say, no, because I'm embarrassed. And they'd say, well, come on, let us take you to school. And because I don't know how to say no twice, I'd say, sure. And I'd slide in the back seat of that car, and they'd look around and say, Bob, how you doing? I'd say, okay, I'm doing all right. How's your mom? She's doing all right. And see, I didn't hear what they were saying, but I could hear what they were thinking. There's this poor boy. He doesn't have a daddy. They live in this small house. His mother has to walk to work, and he has to walk to school. And when I'd get to school, I felt this less than, did not feel a part of, and I can remember in the third grade, Miss Gertrude Rigby, she said, you know, we've got an extra student in here, and said, I'm going to have to do something about that. And what I heard her think was, if Bob McKinney would leave, we'd be okay. Now, I don't know where I got those feelings, but I've heard every alcoholic in this world stand up here and tell his story just like mine. We've all got those same character defects. We all feel the same way. Now, I didn't take my first drink until I was 16, but Hal Ray and Calvin came by the house one day, and they said, let's ride down to the lakes, and we're going to drink some beer. So I didn't think about it one way or the other. So we got in the car, and we rode down to the lake, and on the way to the lake, it's about 10 miles. And you go, and they had a bunch of juke joints on the side of the road, and you old-timers know what a juke joint is. It's an old concrete building that sits about 20 feet off the highway. And it's got concrete bricks, and it's got bars in each window. And it's got beer in one side and wine in the other. And it's always got one letter that's burnt out. And so we'd walk in there, and old Bubba's standing behind that little old bar he had back there, and he said, what can I do for you, boys? And he said, we want to buy some beer. Now, Hal Ray had already had a six-pack before, so we put him in charge. And the old boy said, well, you got an ID? And we said, sure, we do. Hal Ray showed him his. His had a picture of George Washington on it, and I showed mine, and mine had a picture of Abraham Lincoln. He said, that'll do it. So Hal Ray bought us a six-pack of champagne. Now, if you ain't never had it, it's too late. We went down to the lake, and we sat up on that bank, and Hal Ray popped the top, and he gave us all a bottle. I drank mine down, and nothing happened. I automatically said, I believe I'll have another. I drank that second one, and guess what happened? I transferred out of that world of reality, that false world, that drunk's paradise. Bill Wilson calls it utopia. I can't live in the real world, but I can live in utopia. Because, you see, that's where I was safe. That's where I could plan, and that's where I could dream. And the best feeling I have ever had in my life is that first 5 minutes when I took a drink. I mean, it was magic. It was magic. I went on to graduate from high school, and I will have to tell you that I had a pretty good high school. I was captain of the football team and captain of the basketball team. So when that sort of laid the ground for me to become a professional football player, and I'll tell you about that a little later. So anyway, I graduated from high school, and I went off to college, and I went to this college where the girls outnumbered the men 4-1. And I loved that college, man. I tell you, it was a party school, and out of about 10 or 12 girls, I found her. And we are good at finding her. And we started dating, and we started having a good time, and we started doing this and doing that, and after about a year, she asked me to marry her. And I thought it was sort of funny the way she asked me. I said, you're what? And that's what you did back there. So we got married, and she got her degree, and we moved to Charlotte, North Carolina. Now, we're living in Charlotte, North Carolina, and she gets a job as a school teacher, and back then I was between challenges. For you newcomers, that's jobs. I'm sitting in the Rascal one night in one of my home bars, and an old boy came in. His name was Joe. He's not one of us. And we sat down, and we were fellowshipping, two or three of us. Sterling called it something else. And we're sitting there fellowshipping, and old Joe looks over at me, and he said, now, what are you doing now? And I said, well, I'm looking for a challenge. And he said, well, my company's getting ready to hire some sales reps. He said, I don't know whether you'd be interested in this or not. He said, can you travel? I said, what do you mean? I said, can you leave home on Monday and come back on Friday? I said, hell, I'd do that anyway. He said, we sell communications equipment. We'll give you a company card. We'll give you a credit card. And we have found that we get a lot of business after 5 o'clock. And I knew exactly what he was talking about. So I got on with that corporate 500. I stayed with him for about 29 years and 6 weeks and worked for him for about 14. Now, I tell you that to say this. I'm an alcoholic, and I got a big mouth. And I know how to work people, especially when they drink and they want favors. And so I just sort of drank myself right on up the ladder. And we can do that till we get to a certain point, and then it doesn't work anymore. But back then, I started lying. And I mean, I know that surprises everybody in here. But anyway, I'd come out in this life. But see, I would do anything and say anything to make me feel better than you. I always wanted to be a big shot. So I used to tell people I had this taught you this story. You know, I'd go in these good old bars about 11 o'clock in the morning, and we'd sit down, and my drink of choice was vodka and Gatorade. And if you ain't had that, it's too late. But we'd sit in these good old boy bars, and I'd be sitting there, and this old boy would be saying, "What do you do now, hotshot?" I said, "Well, I retired. Since I retired, I'm a traveling salesman." He said, "A traveling salesman?" He said, "I'm retired." He said, "You don't look like you're young enough to retire." I said, "What'd you retire from?" I said, "Well, I used to be a professional football player." And if you're a professional football player in the South, you are king. Just ask them Georgia fans, and I'll tell you. He said, "You play professional football?" And I said, "Yeah, play professional football." And man, they'd slap me on the back and start buying me drinks, and I'm in hog heaven. I got transferred down to Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm sitting in the Scotch House one night. I had them 3 feet, 3 deep in the bar, telling my story, professional football player. This old boy sitting on the right over here, he's eating it up. Ernie's eating it up. And this guy sitting over there, he ain't saying nothing. And finally, he turns around and he looks at me and he said, "Pardon me." He said, "You used to play professional football? And an alcoholic can tell by voice what's getting ready to come down." And I'm saying, "Yeah," and I'm trying to get him quiet. And I said, "Yeah." He said, "When?" I said, "I don't know, 1962, 1970. "Where?" I said, "It's getting ready here." I said, "New York?" He said, "New York Giants?" I said, "Yeah." And it got real quiet. And he said, "You know, I had season tickets to the New York Giants home games for about 10 years. And he said, "What position did you play?" And you can't remember a defensive back. You might name a defensive back in this room. I said, "I was a defensive back." And man, it was quiet. And he looked over at me and he said, "You know, I was there the day you intercepted a pass and ran it back for a touchdown." That old boy drank free the rest of the night. I can guarantee you that. When I got into rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was in a meeting, and I was chairing the meeting, and an old buddy of mine, Jim, was sitting in the back of the room, and this guy, Frank W., walked in and sat beside him. And Frank said to Jim, said, "You know who that is up there?" And he said, "Yeah, that's Bob McKinney." Frank said, "Yeah, I know. He used to play professional football." I'd do anything to make me feel better. So my wife's working, and I'm not respecting the institution of marriage, and I'm running all over the country. And I'm drinking, and I'm drinking about every day. And finally, I'm starting to get in trouble. The day I took my first drink, that bottle of champagne, and let me get my drunk log out of the way, because we all got these stories, and we ain't going to sit here and, "Can you top this? Can you top that?" I've had 60 UIs since I drank. I had 3 wrecked cars. I almost killed a 19-year-old kid in 1969 in a blackout. I walked out on a wife and 2 daughters in 1981. I filed a federal bankruptcy. The worst thing I ever done in my life was con my poor mother out of most of her money. And that's basically what I did. If you would have told me back then, when I took that first drink, that was what was going to happen to me, I'd say, "No, no way." Because you see, I think when I took my first drink, I quit living and started existing. See, I was always between somewhere and goodbye. And so I'm running around acting half crazy, drinking all the time. You know, I'd stay on the road about a week, and I'd come home, and I'd be drunk when I got home, and I'd take my wife and 2 girls out and give them a lesson in drunk driving. And run around to a restaurant, and, you know, they'd eat and I'd drink, you know. Next day, I'd say, "You know, I got to run down to the office and do some paperwork." I'd come in at 5 o'clock in the afternoon drunk. And she said, "Well, you said we were going to cook out tonight." So I'd say, "Well, we'll cook out tonight." So I'd get the grill out, throw a couple of hamburgers in the dirt. And you know, I'd just drink and pass out. I'm laying in the bed one morning. and it's quiet. And when it's quiet around me, it makes me nervous. And I'm laying in that bed, and I can hear them in there whispering. And here I am laying in that bed. I got a beautiful wife. I got a beautiful home. I got two beautiful children. Got a great job, two cars, two dogs, whatever, whatever, whatever. And I'm saying, what's wrong with you? What's wrong with you, Bob? And the next thought that came through my mind, God, I need a drink. I'm an alcoholic. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, it says I'm powerless over alcohol. No, I'm not powerless over alcohol. Alcohol was my solution because it took me out of reality, and I don't know how to live in reality. So I'm rocking along there, and I don't know, probably none of y'all had this problem before, but I had some financial difficulties because of my habit. And see, I got one, and that was my enabler, and that was my poor mom. Now, my mom's a nurse by profession, and she works at Clarendon Memorial Hospital. Mom made a lot of money back then, maybe $8,000, $9,000, $10,000 a year. And she's living in that little white house in Manning, and she's so proud of them, I'm sort of ashamed of. So I'd run down to Manning when I'd get in financial difficulties, trying to get out of a DUI or whatever. And I'd say, Mom, I said, she said, how you doing, son? And I said, well, not doing too good, Mom. Not doing too good. And she said, well, what's the matter? And I said, well, son, I mean, Mom, I'm just having some financial problems. Can you loan me $500? She said, $500? She said, that's a lot of money. But, Mom, I'll pay you back. She'd write that check out, Bobby McKinney, $500. I'd take that check and I'd run up to the Bank of Clarendon where a good high school friend of mine worked. She's not one of us. Her name is Bootsy. I said, Bootsy, can you cash that check for me? She said, sure. She said, how do you want it? And I said, I want big bills because I'm a big shot. She'd put down 100. She'd put down a 50. She'd put down another 50. And she'd stop. And she'd look at me. And she said, Bob, how's your mom doing? I said, Mom's doing fine. She'd give me another bill, a 50, a 100. She'd stop and she'd look at me. And she said, how's Bob doing? And I hated her because I knew she knew. And see, one of the things when I did things that I wasn't supposed to do as a result of my alcoholism, and I don't know whether you've had this feeling or not, but guilt would just eat me up. But I know how to deal with guilt. I'd go out and sit in that old company car, and on the way out of town, I'd get my vodka and Gatorade. And I'd start doing one of the most dangerous things that an alcoholic can do, and that's drink and think. And I'm on the way back to Charlotte where we live, and I'd have a couple of drinks, and I'd say, you know what? I'm going to start being a better son. Have a couple more drinks. I'm going to start being a better husband. A couple more drinks, I'm going to be a better father. About two more drinks, and I'm going to get man of the year in North Carolina. 3 or 4 days later, I'd come to God knows where with God knows who. And I'm shaking, and I'm scared, and I'm weak, and I feel bad, and I got the poor me's. And you know that fear that we have when we know we're in trouble. And I'd find that old bottle, and I'd knock down a couple of drinks, and I'd walk up, and I'd look in that mirror, and I'd say, you know, it ain't that bad. Not today. So I'd run that drunk out for 2 or 3 more days, and then I'd call her. I'd say, honey, if you let me come back one more time, if you let me come back one more time, I promise you I'll change. She said, do you promise? I'd go home and I knew I was going to get the third degree. And I remember one day we were sitting in the kitchen and she was running me through this, why do you do this? Why do you lie to us? Why do you stay gone? Why do you come home drunk all the time? And on and on and on. And I thought for a few minutes and I said, if I could take every thought I had in my head, and I could tell you every feeling that I had in my head, and if I could tell you every character defect that I am strapped with, and I could put it in your head for 5 minutes, you'd never ask me that question again. Because, see, nobody understands the alcoholic like the alcoholic. I used to go to psychiatrists. I was sitting in a psychiatrist's office one day, and I was telling him about how I drank. And he said, I understand. I said, you understand? He said, yeah, I understand how you feel. I said, have you ever been dragged out of a bed at 3:30 in the morning by two cops in Greensboro, North Carolina, thrown in jail and you don't know what you did? And the next morning they tell you almost killed a 19-year-old kid and you get a bondsman to get you out of jail and the first thing you do is go get drunk. He said, do you know how I felt? And he just looked at me. Nobody understands an alcoholic and how we feel. We walk in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, we tell that story and say, yeah, we understand. We understand. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I rocked along there for a while, and I'd go back to see my mom about every 3 or 4 months and say, Mom, how about let me have $700? How about $1,100? How about $1,300? $1,800? $3,300? How about $7,000, Mom? This time's going to be different. We stand in that little doorway of that little old white house she was proud of, not ashamed of. I told my mom I loved her, and this time's going to be different. Let me tell you how it got different. My mom had retired. She called me one day and she said, son, she said, I think you ought to come down. She says, I'm having some trouble. So Dr. King wants to put me in the hospital, and that's who she'd worked for about 30 years. I came down to Manning, and I went by that little old house, and she had a will out on the desk, and she had some plans on her for a funeral on the other side of that desk. And I said, this thing must be serious. So I went out to the hospital, and the nurse said, well, she's got this disease, Bob, she's got this cancer in her stomach, and said, the only thing we can do for her is keep her keep her without pain and keep her safe, keep her sound until she passes. And I sat in that room, and I sat in that hospital room one day, and she came out of that deep sleep, and she looked over at me, and she said, son, will you come over? I want to talk to you. I went over, and I sat down on that bed, and my mom looked at me, and she took my hand and put it between her two hands. And she said, son, I know the end's near. Will you stay with me? I said, Mom, you know I'll stay with you. You know I'll stay with you. I can hear that telephone ringing in that flea bag motel that I'd passed out in that night when I left. Nurse said, you better get here and get here quick. When I got there, my mom had already left. I buried my mom, and two days later, did not shed one tear, got drunk at her funeral, went home about 2 or 3 days after I stayed down and tried to take care of everything, and walked out on my wife and two daughters. Because you see what had happened, see? Because of my habits and not respecting the institution of marriage, a friend of mine down in Greenville, South Carolina, had fixed me up with this lady. So I went down, and he said, Bob, go over here and knock on the door, and said, you'll recognize her. So I went over to Woodbridge Apartments, and I knocked on that door, and that door opened, and I said, the best-looking woman I have ever seen in my life. She had a glass of wine in her hand. I had a company card and a credit card. I knew she was my kind of girl. She knew I was my kind of man. We fell in sick right then. We went out that night, and she didn't care how much I drank, and I didn't care how much she drank. About 12 o'clock in the morning, they had this classy place that opened at 12 o'clock at night where you go by and have a nightcap. And so we sitting in there drinking about 3 o'clock in the morning, and she could drink more beer than anybody I've ever seen in my life. And we sitting in that morning, she gets up to go to the bathroom. She falls flat on the back, and I picked her up, and I said, honey, will you marry me? Shortly thereafter, we moved in together. Now, she's got a little 4-year-old boy about another marriage, and I don't like him, and he doesn't like me. His name's Rob. Yeah. Because, you see, Rob's there. And I don't like anybody interfering with my drinking. And that little boy, for the next 3 years, let me tell you what he saw and what he witnessed. Yeah. He'd see his mom and I, we'd go out and get drunk just about every night. He would stay with his grandma. He might wake up in the morning and he'd see me passed out on the floor, and sometimes I'd be clothed and sometimes I wouldn't. He'd see me, one Christmas he saw the cops came and they were getting ready to lock me up because I'd gotten a fight. One night, One morning, he opened his mom's bedroom door and he caught us in a rather conspicuous situation, and you know what I mean. Let me tell you how that little boy reacts to that. He's 4 years old. About 3 a.m. in the morning, he starts screaming and yelling. And he wakes me up, and I run down that room, and I said, shut up and go back to bed. And he's taking his fist, and he's beating it up on the wall just like a wounded animal. That went on for 3 years. 3 years that went on. He turned 7 years old, and this lady that I'm living with, and by the way, she's one of us. This lady that I'm living with, she said, look, I'm taking Rob and some of his friends down to the skating rink. We're going to have a little skating park. Would you go get him a cake? I said, absolutely, I'll go get him a cake. And so I got drunk, passed out. That's my M.O. Came to about 3 o'clock. It was a note on the counter. Said, you get out of our lives. We don't ever want you in here again. You will never treat us like that again. And I don't know what I'd done. But she tells it better in her story, and I tell it in mine, because what happened, she'd gone down to this place called the Family Mart to get her son a birthday cake, and she had him with him. And I'm good and drunk, and I go down, and I start screaming and yelling, and we get in this big fight right there in the Family Mart. And that little boy looked at his mom, and he said, Mom, if you just don't drink, it'll be okay. I went home that night. And I sat on the counter because she told me to get out. And I'm sitting on the couch. She'd taken him to the party. I sat on that bedroom and I was drinking vodka and Gatorade. I didn't come to Alcoholics Anonymous. I ended up here. Because I took a drink that night, and I'm toxic with alcohol because I've been drinking a quart and a half every day for about the last 3 or 4 months. And I'm full of fear because I know I can't stop drinking. I don't know whether I wanted to live or I wanted to die. But when I took that drink and nothing happened, I can tell you right now, terror and bewilderment, frustration and despair hit me like a bat. And then God threw something in too. He said, are you lonely? I'm the loneliest man on the face of this earth. Liv and her son came home about, I don't know, 10, 11 o'clock that night. And I said, honey, I need help. She said, I've already been talking to your boss, and we made arrangements. I said, whoa, let's don't get that serious about thing now. I said, I needed help. She said, I want you to call Lewis in the morning. I called Lewis in the morning, and Lewis, and try to convince him one more time that I don't have a problem. And he didn't say a word. Now, I'm an alcoholic. If you want to argue with me, I can turn things around and make you lose. He didn't say one word. And I'm getting nervous. And finally, he said, Bob, I'm on the way to Greenville to get you. He said, if you leave, leave. Because you're through. We're tired of fooling with you. He came up the next day, and he took me down to Peachwood Hospital in Greenville, South Carolina. And my future wife at that time, she sat in the front seat and drank a beer on the way down. And I'm sitting in the back seat with my last half a gallon of vodka and Gatorade. And when we got down to that hospital, two big old men came out and they got me because I didn't want to go in. And they put me in a room where they put one little old bed in there and they strapped me down. And they started giving me shots and vitamins and everything. And I stayed in that room for about 9 or 10 days. And let me tell you something. I don't know whether you've ever seen the three-headed snakes, but they do exist. Purple buffalo, a lot of yellow monkeys, 10-foot spiders. And I was in there about 8 or 10 days, and I was detoxing, and I was nervous, and I was scared, and I was crazy. After that, they put me over in the treatment side. And there's about 75 of us drunks in there. One morning we had a session in a room, and they talked about this doctor stood up, Dr. Bill C., and he said, I'm going to talk to you today about a disease called alcoholism. And I'm sitting here thinking, oh, God, here we go. He said, how many people in this room have got out? I asked my mom when he left. I said, is he coming back? And she said, no, he won't be back. I built a wall around me, and I carried that resentment and that hate and that anger until I was 18 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank God for Bill Wilson says we seek professional help. We need it. We need it. Now, I'm sitting in that treatment center, and I get out of there, and I come running to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I grab this old gal I'm living with. I said, come on, honey, we're going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, man. And we went to 9,428 meetings that first year. And I'm running for Rookie of the Year. And I mean, I've got it. After about 3 or 4 months, I'm going to write a book on how to enhance your spirituality. We're going home one night, and I said, honey, I really don't think they understand when I try to explain humility to them. And she looked at me like I didn't know whether she was going to cry or laugh, you know. Let me tell you something. I had 3 sponsors the first year. 3 sponsors in name only. Name only. Yeah. See, let me tell you how I stayed sober the first year. I worked the promises. Yeah. Somebody read them up here a few minutes ago. When I took a drink, I found a new happiness and new freedom. I knew how intuitively how to handle situations. Yeah. Fear of people and economic left me immediately. I stayed sober on working the promises and AA cliches. And sometimes I just feel like I'm walking on the, riding in the seafood of life. Yeah. I just feel like sometimes I'm backing up to an escalator. Yeah. If you don't pick up, you don't have to put down. And I'd hear somebody saying that and I'd run over it. The next day to the meeting, and I'd lay that out there, and they thought, my God, that old boy's got it. I picked up my 1 year medallion, an old boy sitting out in the car. I came out, and he said, Bob, can I talk to you for a few minutes? I said, yeah. His name's Jason. He said, Bob, you just celebrated a year of sobriety, didn't you? I said, yeah, I did. He said, Bob, I've been in a lot of meetings with you. And he said, you know, I've heard you share a lot. I said, oh, well, you know, he's getting ready to compliment me. I said, you have, Jason? He said, yeah, and I just want you to know something. I ain't never got a damn thing out of what you shared. He said, why don't you go read how it works? I went home, wiped the dust off the big book, sat down and read how it works, and it says, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Now, I got 3 sponsors by a name only, and this was this old man that I didn't like in AA. Sterling Fletcher Walsh III, he's already gone to the big meeting. He told a story out at the Alano Club one night, and I did not like him. He put the fear of God in me. After he told his story, I said, Sterling, will you sponsor me? Because I thought he was going to think that was an honor to sponsor me. And he looked at me and laughed, and he said, I've been waiting on you. Let me tell you the first thing that man taught me, the difference between convenience and commitment. He said, now here's how we're going to do this deal. He said, we're going to work these steps. We're going to go through the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. You're going to get a home group. You're going to call me every day. You're going to be active in that home group. You get there before I do, and we'll see if we can't get you sober. God, I hated him. He never did understand me. I mean, you know. I called him one day and I said, he said, what now? You know. I said, I'm married this old girl that I'd been living with, and she's a school teacher, and she come running home, take her clothes off and string them all over the house and get back in the bathtub back there and take a hot bath. And I called Sterling. I said, Sterling, I can't handle this anymore. He said, what are you talking about? And I said, told her about her leaving her clothes all over the house. He said, that bother you? And I said, yeah, it bothers me. He said, pick them up. I thought to myself, here I am trying to grow spiritual, and he's telling me to pick up clothes. Yeah. I don't know what you do when you get sober, you know. I told him, I said, what do you do when you get sober? I said, what do you do with your hands, Sterling? Yeah. He said, what do you mean? He said, let me tell you what you do. He said, go to the mailbox and get the mail. Well, I ain't done that in years. He said, you answer telephones? I never answer telephones. He said, I answer telephone. He said, your wife make the bed every morning? I said, yeah. He said, help her. I said, what is he doing? What is he doing to me? And finally he called on. I was going to a meeting one night. I said, Sterling, I don't think I'm going to share tonight. I'm going to listen. And he looked at me and he said, would you? That man cared more about getting me well than he did hurting my feelings. He took me through those steps, and I'm not going to sit up here and go through every step, but he told me about the first three steps. He said, the first three steps is the ultimate sobriety. I can't, he can, I think I'll let him. He said, now we're going to find out after we take those first three steps and we get on our knees and we pray the third step prayer. He said, relax. He said, because you got a new employer. And he said, now we're going to find out who you are. And I said, we know what you are. You're drunk. Now we're going to find out why you're drunk. And we worked out and took that force. Let me tell you something. I was in a meeting one night. Old boy named Herb. And I was 6, 7 months. I mean, you know, I'm directing everything in there. And we was talking about the fifth step. And he said, well, old Herb said, I took my first fifth step with my dog. I said, my God, what's he doing? Won't he upset these newcomers in here? And I'm 6 months, right? I walked up to him at the meeting. I said, Herb, you ought not share stuff like that in this meeting. I said, newcomers may get upset. I said, what do you mean? I said, how much time you got? And he said, 18 years. I almost asked him what kind of dog that was. We got on our knees. We prayed that third step prayer. We did my fourth and we did my fifth. And I got to tell you, got to open my eyes. I'm insecure. I'm full of resentments. I got a sordid sex life. On and on and on. And I listed those things. After that, we took 6 and 7. The only problem with 6 and 7, I have to keep taking it, and I don't know. Speaker, last night, I call it the step-over steps, the bypass steps, because you do it in an hour. I can't do it in an hour. I have to do it every day. I have to ask God to remove any character defect today that's going to be a maximum, that's going to interfere with me being a maximum service to God and mankind. I started and I said, okay, I'm doing good. I said, what else are you going to suggest to me on what to do when I'm sober? He said, when you get up every morning, knee before you pee. I said, what? He said, hit your knees before you pee. And I never thought about that. Bill Wilson says every time we wake up in the morning, we play the next 24 hours a day. Yeah. I still do that. Because I'm married to a beautiful lady, and if I don't plan my day to get out of the house, she's got something for me to do. This lady I lived with for about 3 or 4 years. We got married. Now, let me tell you the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Between my wife, my daughter who's here, my stepson, my stepdaughter, my first cousin, we got over 135 years of recovery. Life is wonderful today. Life is wonderful today. You know, we got 4 grandkids, and I can tell you this right now. We got one that's 3 years old, and I tell you, Dabo Sweeney and the coach from Georgia have already offered him a scholarship. He's over at the house. He spends the night with us one night a week. And he told Mimi, he said, Mimi, I got a poo-poo. And she put him on the toilet, and he said, now I need my privacy. She came back about 5 minutes ago, and he said, Mimi, wipe my hiney. And I'm sitting there thinking only a three-year-old can say something like that. I got a little 11-year-old grandson. Pick him up in school, and he said, "Pop." I said, "What are we going to do today?" He said, "How much money you got, Papa?" I got a grandson who plays at the University of North Carolina soccer. He got to spend summer with us this summer. I got a granddaughter just got married. I was able to go to that sober. Now, I'm going to tell you what the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, somebody asked me one time, says, what's Alcoholics Anonymous ever done for you? What's it given you? I said, everything. Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything. I said, what gifts does it give you? I said, one of the greatest gifts it's ever given me is I lay down at night and I go to sleep. I don't jerk too. I don't have to call a lawyer. I don't have to worry about getting out of jail. My mom's gone, so I can't con money out of her anymore, which I wouldn't anyway. But Alcoholics Anonymous has given me everything. And I can tell you, as a result of me being sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was educated, we were able to educate three children, two daughters and one son. Got to walk down the aisle with two of my daughters. Got to be the best man at my son's wedding. Got to pay for all of them, too. I told Sterling, I said, Sterling, this is getting out of hand. He said, no, it's not. He said, that's part of your amends. When we got to that ninth step, I had to make amends. And some of them I was scared to make. I made amends to my oldest daughter. And it took her 9 years to accept my amends. She finally wrote me a letter and said, well, you okay? My youngest daughter, who's in this room today, she was becoming one of us at that time. I made amends to my ex-wife. And I knew when I left that that was not complete. I just knew it because I didn't have that feeling. 31 years later, I was sitting in my office, and I got a phone call. And I answered the phone. She said, I just want to tell you, we're okay. The book of Alcoholics Anonymous says one day they'll come around if you do the right thing. I owed a man some money in Greenville, a man in South Carolina. I went down and I paid him. I said, Carl, you probably won't remember this, but I owe you this money. He said, oh, yeah, I remember it. They don't forget. I gave him his money, and I said, I'll pay you interest. And he said, nah, Mom. He said, it's okay. He said, you know, I've joined the church, and I'm feeling happy now, and I'm helping others. And I said, really? He said, yeah, you know, he said, I run this farm out here, and that's time of year. I need to pick up help when I can to pick the cucumbers or whatever. He said, I was in town the other day and said, this old bum was sitting on the sidewalk. And I walked up to him and I said, partner, what are you doing? You don't look familiar around. He said, no, I'm trying to get to Florida. And he said, I'm just bumming around. He said, looking for a job. And I will work. Carl said, well, I can't use you for another week. He said, I felt real sorry for him and I thought he was honest. So I took that van and I put him in that hotel out on the edge of town. And he said, told him, said, give him two meals a day and I'll come back in a week and get him and I'll pay the bill. He said, I got to go pay that bill today. He said, my wife Margaret asked me last night, she said, honey, where are we going to get the money to pay that bill? And he says, you showed up. The more you give, the more you receive in this program. There's no shortcuts. No shortcuts. I went to make amends to another man that I grew up with in Manning. I worked for him. And I walked into his store and I was going to pay him back. And they said, I'm sorry, he died about 6 months ago. I called Sterling and I said, Sterling, I've tried. He said, that's not good enough. Call his wife. I said, do I pay her? He said, no. He said, you call her and ask him. Said, you're sorry about him passing, but you call her and ask her, him, her, what was his favorite charity? And you donate that money to that charity. My sponsor didn't cut me any slack. You're going to do it 100%. If you don't do this, I found out if you don't do this program 100%, you ain't 100% sober. And I know that today. I can remember many times that I get to a plateau in sobriety. And I say, is this all there is, God? And there's two answers to that. Can be. Poor Boy Rice told me in Sterling one time, maybe some of you folks remember Poor Boy Rice. He's lying on his bed with cancer. He got sober in prison. And Sterling and I went to see him, and he said, Poor Boy, tell this hotshot how you stay sober when you hit the wall. Poor Boy looked up, and he said, you keep seeking. He said, you keep seeking. I see so many people come into Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, and they get to a certain point, and they don't seek anymore. You know? They think Alcoholics Anonymous is changing. I've been here 36 years, and I can tell you right now, the big book hadn't changed. Alcoholics Anonymous hadn't changed. What has changed is sponsorship. I got to sponsor people just like I was sponsored. Sterling Watts died about a year ago, and he always told me to get to the meeting before I do. And if I didn't get to the meeting before he did, he'd give me that look. I said, my God, I'm sober 30-something years. Quit doing that. I tell you all this to tell you that I got a beautiful wife today. I got 4 beautiful grandkids, 2 beautiful daughters. They say in Big Book on one page 164 that if we stay close to him, great events will happen for us and countless others. And let me tell you a little bit about the greatest events I've had. One of the greatest events that ever happened in my life is, like I say, we got over 135 years of sobriety. Let me tell you another great event that happened. I just turned 80 years old on June the 10th. We got a certain... All my kids were home, and we got about 18 people around there and eating food and telling stories, spitting food over everybody and carrying on and laughing, and nobody's understanding a word anybody's saying. I just sat down on the edge of the couch back there, and I looked up and I said, God, if it don't get no better than this, this is good enough. Yeah, because I remember the times my kids didn't want to come see me. They didn't want to come see me. Yeah. You know, I get to see my kids play sports, and I get to see spend time with them. And see, I always think about this. See, great events in my life hadn't been that I've heard of $1 million. Great events in my life that I hadn't become a senator or whatever. The great events that's happened in my life is the simple things. The simple things. The old timers in this program, they teach us how to live, and they teach us how to leave. In the past year, I've lost my sponsor. I was the last man, I was the last member of Alcoholics Anonymous to see him sober. And I walked in that hospital room, and he was gasping for breath. And I reached down. I kissed him on the cheek and said, thank you, Sterling. Not for helping me, but for helping everybody else. The man that took me to Peachford Hospital in 1983, he was my brother in sobriety. He passed away, and I had to say words at his funeral. Lost my little 18-year-old therapist. Her name was Annabelle. She had a wet nose and 4 paws. I turned into a 5-year-old kid after we put her down. She taught me more about unconditional love than AA's ever touched me. She didn't care what kind of day I had. And I tell you all this to say this. I almost missed it. One more drink, I might have missed it. My wife and I, we went up to Akron, Ohio about a year ago. Looked at the Mayfair Hotel. Bill Wilson looked at that bar. Almost went in it, but he put that last nickel in that phone. In that phone. He called Sister Anisha's. Met Dr. Bob. I've often thought that Bill Wilson had made that last phone call. We all might have missed it. Where would we be today? I love the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I tell you what, I had a problem with this God thing for years. And I said, Sterling, when am I going to see God? How am I going to see God? How am I going to feel God? And he said, you will when you're supposed to. I was speaking in a conference somewhere about 10 years ago, 15, 20 years ago. And I looked out in the crowd, and it was a crowd just about like this. And all of a sudden, I just stopped, and I looked out, and I saw God. And if you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous and you're sober today, I see God. You know? That night that I hit my bottom, and when everything is drained out of my heart and my soul, nothing's left but God. And when I entered this fellowship, I had a God that understood me before I came to understand him. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous is one of the most, is probably the greatest fellowship on this earth. I had one last amend to make. And that was to my mom. And I talked to Sterling. And I said, Sterling, how am I going to do this? I said, you know, she's buried. Gone. He said, go to her grave. Talk to her. I drove up my mom's buried in a little old country setting right outside of Manning. Beautiful white church. Beautiful graveyard. Norman Rockwell ought to paint a picture of that. I drove up and I got out of the car and I walked over to my mom's grave. And she had that headstone. The big book tells us that in each man, woman, and child, in every man, woman, and child, a fundamental idea exists. And that little child in me is shaking and he's scared to death. And he don't know what to say. And all of a sudden it dawned on me. Tell her your story. And I told my mom the story. I know God forgave me. And if God forgives us, I know Mom forgave me. And I walked off that graveyard a free man. My biggest amend that I hope that I've ever made in my life to anybody is I want you to get me out of your head. I have no business in your head because I will damage you. I have got a disease that will kill my children. I've got a disease that will kill your children. I've got a disease that will do horrible things to people. And it's not my fault. But you see, I'm an alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic. And once I take a drink, I can't tell you how much I'm going to drink. I can't tell you when I'm going to stop drinking. And I'll promise you, I can't tell you what my behavior is going to be. I'm so glad today that I'm a sober member of AA. I got my beautiful wife here, and I will tell you that she's got 36 years of sobriety. She's 2 weeks behind me, though. I would embarrass her, but I'm not going to. I love you guys. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. About 15 years ago, maybe 20 years ago, We had an ice storm up Greenville, and good God, it's 6:30. No. Bring it down. About 20 years ago, I'm climbing up a tree with a chainsaw, and I'm going to cut those limbs down, right? I got up about 20, 30, 40, maybe 60 feet somewhere up there, and I fell in the neighbor's yard. Next thing I know, I'm crawling up in my yard, and next thing I know, I'm on a helicopter being carted off to Greenville Memorial Hospital. And it so happened that day that nobody was home except one man in the cul-de-sac. And he just happened to walk by his window in that home and saw me laying in that yard. And he came up and he called EMS. When I got to that hospital, I stayed in there 11 days. Stayed in there 11 days. I got two pins in my pelvis. They examined me. They put me through every machine that God's ever made. I went through therapy. And Greenville Memorial Hospital is a teaching hospital. And they assign you these little cute nurses that will help you. And they got this little cute nurse, and she said, "Mr. McKinney, I'm here to help you. What can I do for you?" And I said, "Well, sweetheart, I'll tell you what you do. Bring me two Big Macs from McDonald's tomorrow." She said, "I can't do that. I'll get fired." And I said, "Nah, I'll show you how to do it." She'd bring me Big Macs. She was such a sweetheart. I'm getting ready to get out of that hospital. She's helping me get dressed. She said, "Now I got to put you in a wheelchair and roll you down to the entrance." She's rolling me down that hallway in that wheelchair. And she said, "Can I ask you something, Mr. McKinney?" And I said, "Sure." She said, "I've been here 2 years and I've never seen anybody had as much company as you have." She said, "You had somebody bring your two puppies up here, and that's strictly against the rules." She said, "Are you somebody important?" I said, "Well, I used to play professional football. Thank you very much."